One of the things that's interesting is that a lot of times people assume that critics don't have any experience being criticized.
Yeah.
I have been a lady on the internet since about 2001. Mm-hmm. So I am not a stranger to people telling me that I am incompetent, stupid.
I'm not laughing. That is awful, but listen, I get it.
It is funny in a way.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Isaac Butler.
And I'm your other host, Ronald Young Jr.
Hey, Ronald, who did we just hear at the top of the show?
That was Linda Holmes, who is an NPR correspondent, host of Pop Culture Happy Hour, and a writer of novels. And I consider her a friend.
Oh, that's amazing. And why did you want to speak to her right now?
So I feel like in a lot of ways, I have like created this niche of myself on the Working podcast as the job pivot correspondent. So I like talking to people who did another boring job and then went into doing something creative. And I had always known about Linda's job pivot. It's very interesting. But this was my opportunity to actually talk to her. And she's actually working on her third novel right now, which I feel like brings a lot of her previous work all together in a very interesting way. So I'm excited for this conversation.
That's amazing. I should say I'm very familiar with Linda's work. I've been reading and listening to her for a long time. So I'm very excited to get to this conversation. For a lot of people sort of our generation, we first became familiar with her work through Television Without Pity. Mm-hmm. Just for our listeners who might not be familiar with it, what was Television Without Pity?
Wow. So Television Without Pity, if anybody watches TikTok recaps, if you are watching YouTube recaps of television, if you are any of those recaps as you know them today, at some point they grew out of what was happening on Television Without Pity. And maybe Television Without Pity didn't originate the television recap, but that's what they're known for. They're known for doing these very deep dive, snarky recaps of reality television that we were watching. So if you didn't watch, you could go back, read the review, see all the snark, find out what happened on Housewives and Survivor and Big Brother. And you get all of this like little snarky context to it as well, which is so much fun. So back then, Television Without Pity was kind of the first to do it in this very specific, uniform, direct way.
Amazing. So I am eager to get started listening, but while I have you here, you wouldn't happen to have anything special for our Slate Plus members, would you?
Oh, you know I do. So full disclosure, sometimes I am a guest panelist on Pop Culture Happy Hour. So I've talked with Linda a lot about various shows and television that are out right now. But in the Slate Plus segment, we talk about her favorite, as a matter of fact, I say desert island television show, something that she would have to take with her on a desert island if she had nothing else. I gave her a choice of a movie or a television show, and she chose a television show. She explains why. And then we talk a little bit about the bar of criticism for certain types of movies and television versus other types of movies and television, which we'll get into when you listen to the conversation. So you should definitely stick around for that.
That's amazing. I am in suspense to learn what the Desert Island show is. And if you are a member of Slate Plus, you will hear that segment at the end of this episode. If you are not a member of Slate Plus, well, guess what? It's really easy to join, and there's a lot of benefits. As a Slate Plus member, you get to hear extra segments on this show and others like the Culture Gab Fest and Care and Feeding. You'll get bonus episodes of podcasts like Slow Burn. And of course, you will never hit a paywall on Slate.com. To learn more, go to Slate.com/Working Plus. Okay, let's hear Ronald Young Jr.'s conversation with the great Linda Holmes.
Who are you and what do you do?
I'm Linda Holmes, and I'm a correspondent at NPR, where I am one of the hosts of Pop Culture Happy Hour. And I also do various other tasks for them covering pop culture. And I am also a novelist.
You've written two books, I've read both of them, and they're very good. Every Drake Starts Over.
Oh, thank you so much.
And Flying Solo.
Yeah.
But tell me, what is your earliest memory of doing something creative?
Okay, so there's two answers I would give. One is there are some very, very early tapes that my dad made on the reel-to-reel recorder that my parents used to have when I was probably like 2 or 3-ish. And he would like talk to me and my sister and talk to us about like our day and everything. And somewhere he's got whatever microphone you used to record into the reel-to-reel tape player. Mm-hmm. And I just lean right over and I'm just eating the mic like an American Idol contestant because you hear me go, eat breakfast. But it's like this, just like a little kid fuzzing into the mic, eat breakfast. And then like 30 seconds later, my dad goes, all right, talk in your regular voice. You're talking in your funny voice. And when I think about that, I think like, yeah, that's me right there. Talk in your regular voice. You're talking in your funny voice. And then the other thing is I wrote a story just like, you know, wrote out on notebook paper because this was before home computers. Wrote a story that was probably about 15 pages long when I was probably in roughly like, I don't know. I want to say it was in like probably first or second grade. Mm-hmm. And to me, the fact that it was 15 pages long was like incredible. That was like,
yeah.
I could not believe I'd written something that's 15 pages long. And it was a story about a girl, unsurprisingly, who went to a place called Tittletown.
Okay.
And so I invented, I was doing all the world building. Mm-hmm. So those are my first kind of my two first creative memories is that I was ham on the mic with my dad and I wrote my first story when I was, you know, quite little and it was in the realm of, you know, fantasy worlds.
I love how conveniently that aligns with your career today. And right? I love that you have a like actual origin story. I think.
Isn't that nuts? It's absolutely wild. And then like both of those things got abandoned for a million billion years. It's not like I ever thought about, like, I want to be on the radio.
Okay. And it feels like I often here on Working, I get to talk to folks who are actually really working, like in non-creative roles, in the most mm-hmm. conventional of working senses.
Yeah.
Because I only recently discovered that you didn't actually start off in writing and cultural commentary.
No.
You went to college, you abandoned your writing dreams. And mm-hmm. what happens next? I think you had a law degree at some point.
Yeah, I did. So I went to college and my first job out of law school, I went back to Minnesota, which is where my family lived by then. And I became a legislative analyst in what's called the House Research Department, which is a nonpartisan staff office for the Minnesota House. So you write bills, you write amendments. You also sit in committee and answer a lot of questions.
So you were writing then. That's interesting.
I was writing. I was always writing. It was a different kinds of writing. Mm-hmm. So I would sit in staff and in committee hearings mm-hmm. and they would say, you know, counsel, can you tell us whether like if we pass this bill, is it going to work this way or this way? And, you know, I'm like 29 years old. I'm like, it'll work like this, you know. So I answered a lot of questions. I worked on labor stuff and commerce stuff and things like that, consumer protection. And I did that for about 6 years. And then I went to work for the state department that does unemployment benefits. And I was their appellate attorney. So I did a ton of that again was all writing. I wrote briefs all the time. And I liked that. And I did that until I stumbled upon a site called Dawson's Rap, which was Dawson's Creek Recaps. And I started to read it and I really loved it. This was like probably 1999 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Read that site, really loved it, fell in love with it. They eventually converted it to a site called Mighty Big TV, which had a lot of TV recaps. And by then I was doing like a little bit of, you know, I was thinking about writing and I missed it.
Yeah.
And I think one of my friends had set up for me like a very primitive website that had just had like a bulleted list of little movie reviews that I had written.
Yeah.
So it was starting to happen.
Got you.
And then I got involved in writing TV recaps. And then it was all sort of this slide toward doing more and more of that and less of the lawyering until I quit my law job in 2007. So I practiced for basically 10 years and then left.
I guess I'm wondering, as somebody who's made a career transition, like from something, you know, I used to be an IT consultant.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So, you know. Yeah.
So when you're doing the other thing and the other thing is kind of what's drawing you, like there's also this sense of kind of like time ticking away where you're just like,
yes.
How many more years am I going to spend doing this other thing when there's this thing that seems to be ramping up that I should probably be paying more attention to.
Yes.
What's it like having a foot in both those worlds and then like kind of like moving along, deciding that it's time to move along?
Well, the thing that happened to me that was really, really lucky is that I adored the people at Television Without Pity so much. Mm-hmm. I adored particularly the people who ran it, Sarah and Dave and Tara. I just loved them so much, and I loved that job so much that when they were bought by NBC Universal, actually, mm-hmm. they went to, you know, work in Rockefeller Center. Mm-hmm. They hired a couple of people to come and be editors, and they offered me a job going to New York to be an editor on that site. And if I hadn't been offered something that I loved so much, that I absolutely could not say no to because I loved the people so much,
yeah.
I don't know how I ever would have left.
Wow.
I don't know how I ever would have left the idea of having like a stable job and an obvious career path and like picked up and moved to New York by myself.
Wow.
When I was like, and I wasn't really young anymore. I was 36, 7.
Wow.
And it seemed late in the game to pick up and move somewhere else.
Yeah, it's like you're supposed to do that in your 20s.
And the thing that's amazing is that I only did that job for like a year. Because what happens when sites get bought is they change and, mm-hmm. you know, the priorities are different and it's not what it used to be. And, you know, you just feel differently about it and management's different and everything. So I only did that job for like a year.
Mm.
However, it was an incredibly important thing to happen because I don't know what else would have gotten me to actually be brave enough to leave my entire life and career in Minnesota, you know, to go do something totally different. So by then I had picked up, I'd gone to New York. It was like, well, that didn't work. Better figure out something.
Yeah,
else.
Yeah, yeah.
And fortunately for me, Stephen Thompson had been a reader of my Survivor and Apprentice recaps. By the time that happened, he was at NPR. And because we'd been friends before either one of us was at NPR.
Yeah.
But by then he was at NPR and he, you know, they were starting to look into like pop culture projects. And so after I left the job in New York at NBC, he recommended me at NPR and I freelanced there while I put together like a blog proposal for them. And that's how that got started. But it was very much like a whoop, whoop, whoop. That didn't go the way I expected.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just try to like find a place to stabilize yourself and just figure out what's going to be next, you know.
Tell me about your relationship with writing at that point, because I think at one point it's a utility that's a function to your job in terms of mm-hmm, when you're doing mm-hmm. it like legally, as opposed to like move on. It's more frivolous. You're having a good time. Then it becomes yeah. a new part of your new job, you know.
Yes.
And then you get this that's kind true. Of even bigger job with NPR where writing is still kind of like the center of what you're doing.
Yeah.
What's your relationship yeah. with writing at this point?
I think at that point, when I came to NPR, for one thing, I was really afraid that I would never find another thing to do as a writer that I liked as much as recapping.
Mm-hmm.
Just because that was such a, it is frivolous, but it's also such a fun way to just write about whatever you want. I got to write about, you know, I obviously got to write about television, which I was super invested in, but I also got to write about like sexism and racism and weird ways that television talked about things and weird ways that it approached power. And, you know, I just wanted to be able to be, I think, satisfied in the same way
mm-hmm.
ever again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I didn't come to NPR to be in radio or podcasting or anything. I came to NPR as a writer.
That is surprising. Yeah.
Because this was like I said, this was like 2008 when
yeah.
I came to, when I pitched the blog to NPR. And also I was writing about pop culture, which
yeah.
was not entirely their thing at the time. And I think, you know, pop culture is one of those terms that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And to me, it's always meant this really broad mandate of like TV and movies. And I mean, you know this about me, like books and games and, you know, but also like really serious things and really like silly things. But I think there are people who worry that it means like celebrity gossip and
yeah.
stuff like that. And so I think there was a little bit of like, I had a little trouble kind of settling into that job at first because I think people weren't sure what to think about me and what I was going to do.
Yeah.
But for the most part, as I actually did that job and I settled into it, I did come to find the writing of that blog, which was very it was a very bloggy moment in history.
Yes.
And it was a very bloggy blog. I often wrote a couple times a day. And I came to find that really, really satisfying. And I really loved that moment in that career. But I freelanced full time pretty much for 2 years. And then they hired me. And also that summer is when we started the show. So 2010 is kind of when the direction of NPR started to, my direction at NPR started to shift a little bit. But during the time that I was writing that blog only, which was like those first couple of years, I loved that.
And the blog, which we've said, I don't think we said the name, is Monkey See, which is an...
It was called Monkey See.
Incredible name. Did you come up with that?
Sort of. I, from the beginning, basically said, I don't care what you call it that much.
Yeah.
And I had this thing that I had told them, which is that I had this theory about why pop culture is interesting to cover, mm-hmm. which is that, you know, should you only cover the really... like most important art, or should you also pay attention to what people are interested in? And I said, like, if you wanted to study monkeys, you should study what ideally monkeys should eat, right? Mm-hmm. That's a good point of research.
Yeah.
But you should also understand what monkeys actually eat.
Yeah.
And so my thing was, pop culture is what monkeys actually eat. And so and so we got talking about monkeys, and somebody came up with the idea of connecting this to Monkey See, Monkey Do, and which wasn't really the monkey reference. I was like, that's fine. And then it appeared on this long list of things that was like, here's all the possible names, like cross off any of the ones that you have a big problem with. And I just, you know, didn't cross that one off. And I didn't think they were going to pick it, but they picked it. And I was like, okay. So that's what it was called. That's how it came to be called that.
It's a very NPR name. I remember when I first heard it, I remember thinking it felt like to me it had both the combination of like, this isn't quite what we normally do, but it's still a name that's like Monkey See. Like, you want to say the rest of it. You know what I mean?
Yes. And I kind of always felt, I used to tell people that like the Venn diagram of comedy and research is basically... the Venn diagram is monkeys,
yeah.
Right? The overlap between silliness and research is monkeys.
Yes.
So that is sort of how it happened. But I didn't really so much pick that name as like not object to that name.
We'll be back with more of Ronald's conversation with Linda Holmes after this. Hey, listeners, Isaac Butler here. Hope you're doing well. Just wanted to let you know, if you didn't know already, every other Thursday we have this bonus show called Working Overtime. It's part of the regular feed if you're a subscriber, but we offer advice on how to get creative work done. And we would love for you to tell us your challenges so that we can help you. Drop us a line at working@slate.com. You can also send a voice memo to that address or give us a ring at 304-933-WORK. That's 304-933-WORK. And leave us a voicemail. Oh, and if you're enjoying this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Working wherever you get your podcasts. All right, now let's return to Ronald's conversation with Linda Holmes.
So you're writing for the blog, you get hired, you're at Pop Culture Happy Hour, and we didn't actually even say the name of the show was Pop Culture Happy Hour, which of course is just your review wrap-up of pop culture. And you do that for many years, and you're still writing. You have the Monkey See blog, you're still doing a writing.
Yes.
So when this type of writing, like the especially the blog writing and what you're doing for NPR is your full-time job, I'm assuming what came next for you in writing was part of what was your joy, was your free time. Am I right in assuming that?
When I got into fiction?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so I had always kind of had it in the back of my mind that it would be wonderful to write a novel someday.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a childhood thing. I did not have a childhood dream to have a podcast. I did not have a childhood dream to be a critic. I did have a childhood dream to write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
But I had never finished one. I had never even come close to finishing one. But I started writing in 2012. I started writing the book that became Evie Drake Starts Over. And I just picked it up and put it down over the course of several years. And yeah, I don't think I took it that seriously when I first started working on it. It was just like a thing that I sometimes played around with, as I had played around with it my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think I just started to feel like, okay, well, I kind of like this and I'm going to keep writing this. And you know, it continued to, it was one of those books where I just kept being interested enough in the people that I wanted to go back and keep writing it. And then, I don't know if you remember this, but the fall of 2016 was sort of a stressful time in a lot of people's lives.
I do remember that, Linda.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you would. And I sort of needed another place to put energy and another place to put thought other than the world. So I started to work on it more earnestly and finished a draft of it almost exactly 7 years ago now in 2017 in March.
So what is your writing practice like at this time? Like, I mean, especially when you're ramping up, because if you're writing for work and you're also writing for like side work, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What is your actual practice like? How are you like separating that in your mind and actually getting work done?
In a couple different ways. I do write at night and early in the morning and on weekends. And since work kind of became more flexible post, like when I started working from home in 2020, and I still work at home, it does give you, particularly with my job, a fair amount of flexibility. Because like if I have to watch something for work, they don't really care if I watch it at 2 in the afternoon or if I watch it at 8 in the evening, right? And so when you have that kind of flexibility, if I feel inspired, I will sit down and write. I also am lucky enough that I have, in sort of my arrangement with NPR, I have a little bit of book leave every year. I have a little bit of extra time off that is specifically for writing on those kind of other projects, and I use it for that. But to be totally honest with you, it is only in the last like literally couple of weeks, as you and I are having this conversation, that I have realized that I don't have enough time and that something has to give. And it's not going to be my job and it's not going to be the books. So it's going to be stuff like, I was thinking, like, I'm either going to have to become one of those people who like does a bunch of meal prep on Saturday and doesn't think about cooking for the rest of the week. Like, I need to make some trims to what I spend time on.
Yeah,
because I don't have enough time. And I do feel the stress of that, even having some extra time and even having that accommodation. It is too much right now. And like I said, it's not going to be my job. I love my job.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be the books. I love the books.
Yeah.
I just have to figure out what else to trim out. And I remember, it's funny, I was remembering an interview with Ira Glass where he was talking about, they were talking about like, you know, how do you do all the stuff you do? And he basically was like, well, I don't remember if these were the specifics, but it was like this. Well, I don't read books or watch television or see movies. And I realized like, like there is limited time on Earth.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the situation I'm in right now, is I'm thinking like, I love to dig into like big, difficult novels to read.
Yeah.
But maybe I can only do that at certain times.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to find where the give is in the scheduling, because I don't have enough time.
You're talking about like, and I think we covered this a little bit on working, the idea of consuming creatively versus your creative output and what that actually feels like the difference is. And I feel like you're in a unique position because you are, according to your Wikipedia page, a cultural critic, which I would agree with.
I am.
Yeah. And I'm glad you consider yourself one as well. So what is it like to be able basically to be consuming, for criticism, the dichotomy of actually putting out something that is going to be consumed critically?
Well, the good thing about that is I have been a lady on the internet since about 2001. So I am not a stranger to people telling me that I am incompetent, stupid, ugly, whatever else.
I'm not like, laughing. That is awful, but so, that, I get it.
Listen, it is funny in a way. Like, I've always been heavily prepared for the experience of being criticized. And one of the things that's interesting is that a lot of times people assume that critics don't have any experience being criticized and they just, that life just does not work that way.
Yeah.
Especially in internet times. You know, at the same time I used to write TV recaps, I moderated the forums, which I really did not like doing, but you know, it was part of the job, which originally was pretty reasonable and became kind of an overwhelming thing after a while. But, you know, so none of that part was new to me. I will say the process of writing the books and then when I think about story now, when I see it in something like a TV show or a film, I am more likely to sit there and think like, okay, now why did this turn out this way? Mm-hmm. And your brain starts to spin out this thing of like, I bet it was originally more like this.
Yes.
And somebody said that it needed to, you know, and this is in here. I think I'm better at thinking like, well, the purpose of this scene is to demonstrate this point because yes. otherwise you kind of wouldn't get it and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
And the biggest example of that is when we had a conversation about Die Hard on the show mm-hmm. at one point, one of the things I said was the umpteenth time that I watched Die Hard, it became clear to me why in the movie you have to have, I apologize for the Die Hard spoilers, you have to have Hans has to shoot Mr. Takagi
yes.
at the beginning.
Yes.
Which is a terrible, terrible moment,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
That has to happen because otherwise you would root for Hans.
Yes. Yes.
That has to be in the movie for that reason. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that anybody at any point said, you need to add this murder, like, in order to make this point.
Yeah.
It just means that structurally, that's why that scene is important. That's why you couldn't take it out. If somebody said, like, this is too violent, it's too ugly, can you take this out? No, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah.
You have to still want him to get Hans, and you have to still be happy when Hans falls off the building.
Yeah.
And for that, it's not even enough for him to kill Ellis.
Yeah.
Because Ellis is Ellis.
Yes.
He has to kill Mr. Takagi.
Yeah.
It's very important to the story. That kind of thing, I think I'm better at noticing since I started to write and edit books where you have to kind of deal with the balance between, you know, what you're trying to get the story to do and how you want the story to feel.
Yeah.
So those kinds of structural things, I think I notice more than I used to. And that's probably the biggest difference. And the other difference is I am much more careful about how I pay compliments, because there are times when people will compliment a book that I wrote and they'll say something like, I really love this book. I just completely turned off my brain. And listen, I get it. I get it.
I get it.
You get it, right? We've all been that person and said that thing.
How rude.
But no. It's not, though.
Yeah,
it's appreciative.
I get it.
But how it feels to be on the other side of that kind of compliment.
Yeah.
And I'm careful about certain turns of phrase. Like when I talk about a movie that I think is really like sweet, unassuming, quiet, there was a moment when I talked about a movie, and this is a great little movie, right?
Yeah.
And I said that like on probably Twitter at the time.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who the director was or what the director said, but the director responded to that and she was very polite about it, but I could tell she didn't like it. And now in retrospect, I understand that much better.
Yeah.
Like I just meant it as this is just a quiet, it's not a gigantic movie. But when you say this is a nice little movie,
yeah,
of course that sounds different to her than it does to me. So I'm actually more careful about compliments than I am about critique, which is maybe surprising.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, those things certainly inform each other. And like, I try not to be a jerk, but I've always tried not to be a jerk.
Yeah.
And I try increasingly over the course of my career not to be a jerk. Like, that's definitely I am more careful what I say in general.
Yeah.
But that's not really about having become a novelist. That's really just about maturing as a person. Like, I'm more thoughtful about what I say, you know.
So you've written two books, and I believe you're working on your third.
I am.
First of all, talk to me about the type of books you've written, and tell me what your third will be. Will it be more of that, or are you going in a different direction?
My first two books are what you would call, what tends to be referred to as women's fiction, mm-hmm. which is,
okay.
They're books that have a love story, but not only a love story,
yeah.
typically, because you know, they don't really qualify necessarily as romances because they have too much else going on. And because they're not as focused on both people in the couple, they tend to be stories of women and kind of they're both about women who fall in love with men. And it's kind of the woman's story.
Yes.
And I think that the kinds of books that I write tend to be about a little bit about self-discovery,
yeah.
a little bit about finding kind of your place in life. I think they're both like that.
Mm-hmm.
The third book started off to be more of a straightforward romantic comedy when I was first writing it, but I set it in the world of audio and podcasting.
Ooh.
And because I set it in the world of audio and podcasting, it became much more of a story about the precarity of the industry in some ways.
Thanks, Linda.
And sort of the precarity of balancing sort of the persistence and the resilience of doing what you love.
Yeah.
In spite of what can feel like the precarity of a particular business model.
Nice.
Right?
Yeah.
So it became more of a novel about, it still has a relationship. It still has that romantic comedy element, but it also has, you know, a lot in it that is certainly not the story of my experiences at NPR, but it's very much informed by like all the other people that I know who work in audio, particularly in, you know, more in for-profit companies and, mm-hmm. and the many that have grown up in the last 10 or 15 years, whatever. So I think it started off to be more of a straightforward relationship book, and it is, it sort of found its way into being more of also a kind of a finding your way through, like I said, that balance of you love doing what you love doing and you're not going to give it up, but you have to kind of navigate the difficult environment that you're in, which would be true, honestly, in like 95% of jobs at some point. Mm-hmm. It's just, it happens to be this industry's sort of moment when everybody's like hyper aware of the precarity of it, you know?
Do we know the title or when it's coming out? Are we allowed to say any of that yet?
Yeah. The title is Back After This.
That's a great title.
Thank you. This is the first title. I got to tell you, this is the first title that I actually wrote and picked.
Yeah.
So the first book, because it's about a baseball player who had the yips, which is like this kind of, you know, you lose your capacity to throw.
Yeah.
In his case, to pitch. I call that book Headcase. Ooh. Because he talks about how everybody thinks I'm a headcase.
Yeah.
And so I called that book Headcase, but the publisher was immediately like, nobody's going to know what that is. Sort of A, nobody's going to know what that is. And B, nobody's going to think that the book is what the book is based on that title.
Yes.
And they were right.
Yeah.
And so that title got rewritten. The second book I called in my original draft, I was calling it Duck Season.
Okay.
Because it has to do with a wooden duck decoy.
Yes.
But that again, like they were like, people are going to think it's about something different than it's about. It's not about hunting. It's not even really about ducks. They're not going to understand people. It's not going to, you know. And eventually you get to the point where the thing a title is supposed to do is communicate what the book is.
Yes.
I mean, it is supposed to, like, you know, raise interest and all that stuff. But it's also supposed to give people a sense of what the book is.
Yeah.
And I think I'm a little better at figuring out how to do that.
Yeah.
Than I was at the beginning. So this is actually a title that I picked myself, and it survived.
That's exciting. I've heard a lot about the world of book titles and how they go through iterations.
Wild.
Do you know when it's coming out yet, or are we allowed to say?
Yeah. Should be out February of 2025. That is the hope.
Linda Holmes, thank you so much for joining us on Working.
Thank you, buddy.
Up next, Ronald and I will talk about taking pop culture seriously, having a thick skin, and the schedule problems inherent in doing creative work. Ronald, that was such a great peek behind the scenes of a really interesting mind and career. And do not worry, I will not say it was a nice little interview. One thing this reminded me of is that Linda Holmes was really at the forefront of the critical movement to take pop culture more seriously. Mm-hmm. She wasn't the only one, but she was really one of the early adopters of that. And this also coincided with the advent of the golden age of television, which made it easier to take pop culture seriously. For our younger listeners, it might be hard to realize this. And for those of us who are older, it can be hard to remember this. But major critics used to be very, very dismissive of popular culture, particularly television and blockbuster films. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that part of what makes Linda's approach special is that she has a sense of humor about pop culture, but she also takes it seriously. Does that make sense to you? What do you think makes her work uniquely interesting?
Well, I think you're 100% right. Like, working with Linda, she not only will tell you that this movie is good or this movie is bad, and actually in Linda's terms, she would be like, I liked this movie or I didn't like this movie, because she's very careful to call a movie good or bad, which I really love the intentioned ways that she uses her words. But she not only talks about why she likes it or why she doesn't like it, she gives you a well-reasoned, articulate discussion on why she does not like it or why she likes it in a way that you would not expect when you're thinking about something like Captain America, The Winter Soldier, which if you go back through the Pop Culture Happy Hour archives and listen to that episode, Linda has a very good metaphor about what's happening with the helicarriers and what that means for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And listening to her, I'm like, you know what? I listened to her. I remember that review when it came out live. I'm just like, I just didn't think that anybody would take something like that seriously and put that much thought into it. But like, art deserves thought, even if it's not high art, air quotes. I'm using very, very violent air quotes here. Even if it's not high art, art deserves thought. And I think that's Linda's brand, is that art deserves thought.
Totally. You know, I loved your question about critics being criticized, because I am a critic and have been criticized many times. It's a reminder that if you're going to make work and show it to the public, whether it's a blog post, a painting, a review, a movie, whatever, you know what? People are going to tell you what they think. And often, if it's on social media especially, and they're anonymous, they can be quite rude about it. Slate used to have a sort of legendarily rough and tumble comment section that I would never, ever look at whenever I wrote a piece because I was just too scared. I have a friend who's like a fairly prominent critic who does not go on social media because he said to me, like, look, I know I have a thin skin and I don't want to get wrapped up in the shitty things people are going to say about me. And I also don't want that voice in my head when I'm trying to write, because my job is to tell the truth about what I think honestly.
Yeah.
I am wondering about how you have developed your thick skin as someone making public work, especially, like, I think about your wonderful podcast, Wait For It, and it's really quite brave in its exploration of fatness in this world and what that subjectivity is like. And I just have to imagine you have to develop a thick skin to make work like that.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I have that thick of skin. I think I'm actually a very sensitive person. But what I found is that if I could remove myself from whatever the stimulus is, then I'm generally okay. Like, I don't really have a problem with it. But I'm like, I think I'm human like everybody else, in that if I see something and it's a criticism of whatever work I'm doing, especially something like Wait For It, my instinct is to immediately, no, that's not, you're looking at this completely wrong. That's like immediately my instinct. But I think, I mean, people have opinions and they're not always right. And I think when I read people's stuff, I have to read it several times before I'm like, what do I think about this? And I have the argument in my head and I do not respond to the comments. I do not give any of that any credence. And I kind of have to move on. So it's really, I've taken more of a brush it off attitude, but really committed to not responding to every comment, to every criticism that ever happens. And sometimes when I do feel nervous, I'm not looking in the comments either. I'm like, you know, why would I do that to myself?
Right. Totally. You know, it's interesting because I feel like, look, we put something out into the world, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
People are going to have a response to that, and they have a right to whatever that response is, and they have a right to express that response. That doesn't mean I have to listen to it, do you know?
Yes.
Or I have to agree with it, but they do have a right to have that response. And navigating that, I have found that tricky. It's interesting. For me, it's like, if I am confident in the work, which isn't necessarily to mean I think everyone's going to like it, but like, I made the piece I set out to make. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I am far more bulletproof when it comes to criticism.
Yes.
You know, because it's like, oh, you didn't like it. Okay, that's fine. You didn't like it. You know, this is what I was doing and you didn't go for it. That's fine. Whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. If you feel good about it, then like, why would I care about what you think?
Yeah. Or you might even be able to learn something from it. You know, like, I've made things that have been panned that I felt good about. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. It's when you're not 100% sure about the project that becomes tough, right? And then in those instances, I'm like, I'm actually just not going to read any of this shit at all.
I agree. Yeah. I think that's I think for me, feeling confident about your work does give you a sense of invulnerability against criticism. But the minute that you start to feel shaky, or you rush this one out, you didn't go through your process, you don't feel so confident. When you see people start pointing out the things that you are insecure about in your work, it becomes this validating force that amplifies your negative self-talk and just continues to like make things kind of spiral out of control in your mind, which is why, like, you know, take the moment, put it out, be confident in it. If people don't like it, just be like, okay, I guess they weren't about it this time, but I stand by that. And if you, like Larry David still stands by the season finale of Seinfeld, which a lot of people hate. And he's still like, nah, that's good. And I'm like, I've watched it a few times. And I'm like, the first time I watched it, I'm like, eh, maybe not. I watched it recently. I'm like, you know, this kind of holds up, honestly. It holds up to the rest of the show. So I don't, and maybe it's because the stakes are lower because years have gone by, but Larry David never stopped standing tall on it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And you can always comfort yourself that history will vindicate you.
That's what you want. Yes.
Yeah. 100 years after I'm dead, people will love this book. I have to say, I also really appreciated the real talk about scheduling, a thing I totally struggle with. I'm going to put my June Thomas hat on and talk about scheduling for a moment. There are a finite number of hours in a day.
Yes.
And we all have obligations other than work. You know, a lot of times this comes up with parenting, but it's not just parenting. I don't know why only parents get the question about their schedule. Also, on top of that, let's just say there are too many good books, movies, TV shows, painting, and video games out there to experience in one lifetime.
Yes.
We all have to make decisions about what we value and what's important. And that might mean giving up some things we really like. Like, I was really struck by the whole thing about, you know, there are large swaths of the culture that Ira Glass doesn't really, you know, engage with because, you know, of the creative work that he has to do. I mean, there's a part of me that would rather not be the host of This American Life than not watch movies or read books or whatever.
Yeah.
I have a writer friend who is just does not watch television because he's like, I have decided that books and movies are the two things, and music. I'm keeping up with those three things. I am not going to keep up with television. There's not enough hours in the day. Do you face similar choices? And if so, how do you navigate them?
I mean, I don't think there's enough hours in the day, but I also am very realistic about having to rearrange the hours for the period of time in which I need those hours. And I think the idea of just giving up something for the rest of your life in order to do another thing, I'm just like, well, you might not always feel like writing. You know what I mean? Like, maybe you just need a break. Maybe you need to be, like right now, I'm rewatching Star Trek Voyager. You know what I mean? And like, that's like filling up a lot of my like before bedtime and wake up time.
You got to get your dose of the hologram doctor.
I have to, man. Like, he just got the mobile emitter and I'm very like, you know, whatever, you know what I'm talking about. But it's like that idea, like I think for me, it's about rearranging the schedule to prioritize the things that I need to be working on. And like right now I have a big writing project coming up that I know that I'm going to be spending a lot of time on over the weekend and next week. And I feel like the sacrifices I make, I expect them to be temporary towards the work that I'm making at the time. And I think that's how I rearrange my schedule. So the sacrifices need to be made. But when Ira Glass says I don't watch television or watch movies, I'm like, come on, man. Like there's gotta be a better way.
Block off some time in your calendar. Yeah, Ira, man, if you're listening. Right? Well, that's about all the time we have this week. We hope that you have enjoyed the show. If you have, I'm going to give you one last reminder to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and that way you will never miss an episode. And also, don't forget, if you join Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like Slow Burn, and you will never hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more, go to slate.com/workingplus.
Thanks to our guest, the great and good Linda Holmes, and our producer, Cameron Drews. We'll be back next week with Isaac's conversation with clarinetist Anthony McGill. Until then, get back to work.